This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Hello and welcome to Birth to Work Radio. This is Elaine Scott. I'm here today with intrepid traveler Rick Stevens and our guest today, Georgia Lambert, a longtime friend, a teacher, a mentor, and possibly a woman of the time as someone who has never used a social security number to apply for a formal job. And something that in this day and age, in this economy, and in this marketplace makes her a very interesting interview, especially in terms of how she's done it and how she has managed to keep herself growing and achieving throughout her life. And Georgia, we are just absolutely delighted to have you here today. And we want to begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about how you've created your own world of work and as a student of the world and a student of great thinking.
Well, it's great to be here with you, Elaine, and also a big hi to Rick. Probably the best place to start would be to remember the great poet Robert Frost, who in one of his most famous poems talked about two roads diverging in a yellow wood and he traveling the one less traveled by. Well, in my case, it's not only a question of the one less traveled by. I sort of created a whole new destination in the center of the woods and forged a whole new road to it. I basically created a career where there was no career before.
And that's absolutely true. I mean, I can't think of a better way to describe what you've done and what you've achieved and accomplished in your life. But was that done... What kind of intent was that done with? In other words, was that what you thought you were going to be doing? Was that something you prepared to do, or was that something that just happened?
Well, for me, it really does go back to childhood. I grew up in a military family, high-ranking military family. And, you know, children of the military either do very well or not well at all. And I thrived in that situation. I loved being a gypsy. And I think part of it was that although our house changed every few years, our home never did. The dynamics of the family system remained the same regardless of our outer surroundings. Also, as a child, my parents read to me, which I think is vitally important. And I just didn't get the regular bedtime stories. I got Celtic fairy tales and Egyptian history and Greek myths and Norse myths. And so growing up largely in Europe in different cultures and having those kinds of stories, I began to realize at a really early age, without even knowing that I was learning something, that humanity is basically the same wherever we go, and that the same story is being told. And I begin to think about the age-old questions that are at the heart of all of the world's mystery systems or religious systems, and those questions are, who are we, why are we here, and what are we supposed to do? And so at a very, very early age, I had a drive to pursue those questions, because how an individual answers those questions and how a group or an organization answers those questions really shapes not only the person and their life, but the civilization in which we live. I found that most of humanity addresses those questions in the wrong order. Instead of who am I, why am I here, and what am I to do, most people immediately focus on the what to do. And so our colleges, which should have always offered a liberal arts education to round out the personality, have become trade schools. And so people have focused on their trade rather than their contribution to this life that we're all living. And you can't know what that contribution is if you don't know who you are. So basically what I do with a long story how I came about it, but formal training in both Eastern and Western mystery traditions, I offer a training that allows an individual to experience over a long-term basis who they really are as a spiritual being, not necessarily religious. And then in finding that deeper level of who they are, they're not their physical body, they're not their feelings, they're not their thoughts, they're the creator of those things. And as they begin to discover who they really are, then the question of why am I here becomes a very different question. And that means taking that expanded consciousness that you achieve and putting it into active service within the world to make the world a better place, not only for ourselves, but for all life upon this planet.
Rick, do you see the parallel there?
Well, there's no question. Georgia, as I've gotten to know you and you've gotten to know me and the work that Elaine and I are doing in Birth to Work, what you talk about and what you just described is the whole notion about, you know, people living together in a society or living together in communities, finding place, finding purpose, and then looking to say, now, given that place and purpose, how do I create value going forward? And it sounds like, you know, in your life, that became an early part of you growing up in a household, you know, that environment, I presume your parents and the community around you created. Can you maybe give us a little bit more flavor? Because I think for our listeners, what's important is the role that we all have about creating the right environment as people grow up. And then a little bit later on the show, I'm sure we're going to get into the dialogue about how to give back. But this growing up and creation environment that we as adults are responsible for creating our youngsters, I think is critical.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was very fortunate in that although as a baby boomer, I grew up during the Cold War, no matter how busy my father was, he always made time for us. And, you know, looking back, value that early training. When we were given picture books, my brother and I, at a very early age, it wasn't just, you know, pretty little kid pictures. It was art books. And we didn't care. All we liked was the pretty colors. But on a subconscious level, absorbing the structure, the geometry beneath those colors, the symbology. And so, you know, as I moved into my teenage years, I did so with an amazingly rich background, not only externally because of the different cultures and languages and so on and so forth, but that which was afforded us at home as well. Then when I became a teenager, we went to Europe on our second tour, and we went to Germany shortly after the wall went up. And there was a defining moment for me. We were actually in Berlin and looking across the barbed wire and seeing the fresh wreaths of those who had lost their lives perhaps the days before. There was one particular section where there wasn't really any barbed wire, but there was a high stone wall with broken glass cemented into the top. And this wall juxtaposed against the side of a church. And in fact, some of the church had been cut away to make room for this this hideous symbol of separation. And right above the wall, there was a niche in the wall of the church, and it showed a statue of Christ. And with this profound look of peace. And I remember as a teenager, all of a sudden turning and seeing that juxtaposition of this horrible separation and the inhumanity that we can do to one another, and yet above it all was this symbol of hope, this symbol of peace, this symbol of really accomplishing something beyond the present moment. And at that particular moment, I remember consciously making the decision that I wanted my life to count for something.
So, Georgia, you were a product of the environment, which is what was going on around you, but also the rich discussions I suspect you had at home, given your parents are giving you art books, you know, that I suspect these weren't the normal dinner table conversations that many people see about what's going on TV. These are about what's going on, current events, what's going on in the environment. And I think when we come back from the break, maybe that'll be a good jumping off point to really, again, help people see the important role that they have as parents to create the environment for growing our citizens of the future. This is Rick Stevens with Elaine Scott and Georgia Lambert. We'll be back right after the break.
Georgia, I want to bring something back around just very quickly that you made a comment about in your last conversation. It was a quote about the house changed a lot, but the home never did. And then you went on to talk a little bit about the creative environment that you had and the notion of what your parents gave, you know, and provided you with. And I think that's such an important thought in this environment that we are facing today in the economy. There's a lot of worry on people's minds about all of their kids having the latest gadgets and having the latest stuff and what they provide for their kids. But before I let you respond, I want to give you something to follow on with because it's a real interesting story to me. I have a friend who's been a part of my life and my family's life for over 20 years, a woman who, when we met her, was in her 70s and had retired from a job as a seamstress in the clothing business. But she was far and away one of the wisest and most creative and innovative and thoughtful people I ever met. She had a great sense of personal dignity and self-esteem and all the right things about a person who continues to sew and be charitable and do things for people in well into her 90s. And I spoke with her just the other day when all of the turmoil began to erupt about the marketplace and the economy and the things that were going on. And I said, where were you in the first depression that this country was in? And she told me a story about where she was. And actually, she and her four brothers and sisters were put up for adoption. And they all were lived either nearby or a couple of them were adopted by this. I mean, it was a really curious and what we would look at today and say it was a very difficult set of circumstances. And she worked all the time, and she was up in the morning early at 5, and she was helping and scrubbing floors and cleaning and working in the cafeteria at school. And yet she said, you know, Elaine, she said, as I thought about it later on in my life, I realized I was never unhappy. She said everybody around me was pretty much in the same place, and I loved being praised for doing work well. I always felt like the work that I did was important because it was what helped keep the house clean and helped make sure that people knew that I appreciated being in their home. And she was self-taught. I mean, pretty much she read and learned to read and on her own. But I go back to her, and here she is in her 90s. She's content. She's taken care of. She has a purpose and meaning in her life. She has values. And I'm listening to you, and granted, you were in a different economic environment, but I'm hearing a similar thread that you didn't know that there was anything lacking, if there was anything in your life, due to the fact that you moved around a lot, whereas a lot of people today consider that something of a problem. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a difficult thing to talk about these days when everybody is into such victim consciousness. But I'll give you an example since you're telling stories here. I had a student some years ago whose whole life, he was a young man, his whole life had been focused around the fact that his father had left him as a child. And he was very much into blaming everything that was going on in his life because he wasn't loved and his father left him as a child. So what I had him do was to look at, instead of focusing on the fact that his father left him, I had him imagine that he chose that situation on some deep level. And I asked him, what did you get? What did you gain that you wouldn't have gained had you had a father? And he had never looked at things like that. And he realized that he gained a certain amount of maturity, a certain amount of experience, a certain amount of self-reliance that was far and above everyone else around him of the same age. So the idea is not so much to focus on what we don't have, but focus on what we do. When I moved around as a child, the idea of losing friends that we had just made was sad, certainly. But it also gave us opportunities to make new ones. It gave us opportunities to try out things that we wouldn't get to had we lived in one place. For instance, I tried out all different kinds of nicknames. If I didn't like one, next time we moved, I tried something else. If I did something stupid as a young teenager and was embarrassed by it, there was always some place new to go where I could start over. So it's always, you know, a situation of looking at opportunities. And one of the things that contributed to that was certainly my parents. And it wasn't that they were super parents. In fact, probably my relationship with my parents was just like anybody else's. There was a generation gap. There wasn't a lot of talk on certain issues. But my father recognized some drive in me. And although we didn't discuss a lot of things, he supplied me with every book that I wanted. And so I, at a very early age, like 12 and a half, I was reading books on comparative religion, philosophy, psychology.
So he never assumed that you were not capable of anything. He just let you explore and grow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that really gave me the education which blossomed into what I do today.
And that was one of the examples I wanted you to mention was some of the experiences that you had in taking that and growing your education besides going on to college. You then took and combined several worlds together.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking the art and then that growing up learning, and you have moved it out into talk a little bit about the work that you did at the osteopathic college.
Well, before, Georgia, you dive into that, I'd just like to make a point, Elaine, which I think is important for our listeners, and that says, hey, challenge in a young person's life is an extremely important part for them helping find themselves as well as understand and learn their capabilities and capacities. And as we think through all of our own personal lives, I'm sure we can all reach back to say, you know, there were circumstances I may not have wanted to be in, but we all would look back at those and says, but I became much better for it because of that adversity, because I had to do it on my own, learn on my own, create that environment. So I think, there's a great point, I think, for all of us to recognize the importance of our role as parents, not necessarily make it easy, create the environment where we can, all of our youngsters can grow. So sorry for that interruption.
No, I think that's so important,
but I want to get that across.
Rick, because we seem to live in a culture where the idea of allowing your children to experience pain is just something that's not done. And that's so wrong. I mean, if you look at a butterfly emerging from a cocoon, if you peel the cocoon away, the wings won't be strong enough to fly. So the idea of creating successful adults that can deal with life is you learn what to do with the extremes. And if you are not allowed to experience the extremes, then when they come as an adult, you have absolutely no capability of dealing with them. So one of the things that I found wonderful about my situation was that we were allowed to experience extremes, both emotionally and mentally and physically, and they started off small in safe, you know, controlled environments, but it gave us the wherewithal to live in lots of places, to meet lots of people, to go into any situation and feel comfortable, and to recognize that the wealth of our human experience is the ability to reach these extremes and still be whole.
You said that very well. So I apologize again for interrupting in terms of getting a response to Elaine's question, but that was a terrific feedback. I think so important for all of us.
I also think in light of what we're looking at today, which is why I was bringing up this notion about the osteopathic college and the work that you did there, was that when you went to teach and you took this breadth of experience, not just from the viewpoint of the technical side of what you learned, but the, I'm going to say sort of a combination of spiritual wisdom and technical knowledge. You kept pushing the envelope. You kept bringing things together that allowed people to see, almost like seeing behind, the surface of what's there and seeing the reasons why things existed. I remember in class, having studied with you for so many years, when you would talk to us about the brain, for example, and you would talk about the original names of different parts of the brain. I think you talked about the, botch it here, but you talked about the different parts. But I remember that you talked about them. The rooster or the crow.
Well, yeah, but you know, the thing is that what we forget is that each age and culture has a different way of looking at those questions. You know, the who, the why, the what. In the past, this has largely been the province of religion, both East and West. Today, it's science. And the two are merging. You know, back in the 70s, you had books being written that equated Eastern mysticism with Western science. And that's really where things are going. It's not an either-or anymore. We've passed the age where if someone has a spiritual calling, they retire to a monastery. Today, we have to live in the world and bring that vision into making things better here. So this has necessitated my work having different layers or levels, like an onion, where the outer layers are things that average humanity can relate to and understand.
Hold on, we're going to come right back to that. We're going to pick up right where you just stopped.
No problem.
This System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott, is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The system, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birthtowork.org or amazon.com.
Georgia, just before we went to the break, you were just starting to say something about the fact that long before we got into the world of scientific thought where we are today, that world was largely the domain of the religious community. And such things as I was alluding to, like the parts of the brain,
right,
and how they were named, and how and you were saying, go ahead and please continue with what you were saying about how that naming actually occurred according to the time that people were in.
Well, I think the wider question is that these age-old questions of who, why, what were the province mostly of religion, some science when we are talking about the period of the Renaissance. In fact, as you were talking about the parts of the brain, if you look at the fathers of all modern science, they were all mystics. And, of course, our history books don't go into that side, but It has certainly been the case, and there was great meaning attached to naming the parts of the brain, for instance. But basically, what this has to do with is the work that I do has different layers, like an onion. And the outer layers have to do with things that mainstream humanity can know and understand. So in my studies of combining both Eastern and Western traditions, there is a lot of Eastern stuff that is now scientifically applicable in the West. And one of the big areas that opened up for this in the late 70s and the 80s was the holistic health field. And so I find myself this sort of strange duck of not having any degrees in what I actually do, and yet at the same time being able to speak for various holistic health organizations, most of the colleges here in Southern California. I was a chief speaker at the National Cranial Conference, sponsored by the American Osteopathic Association. And for these scientific organizations, I can talk about how does internal discipline not only change your consciousness, but what are its effects on the brain and nervous system? And what does that do for the individual? And then, from the individual, how does that affect the way they approach their life, their environment, and their external interactions?
In other words, the very notion of what business leaders have read for years called the laws of success, which have to do with discipline and setting priorities and focus and plans and all that sort of thing, is all very much based on the much more ancient knowledge.
Exactly, but it's applied in a new way, and it's in a non-inflammatory language. You know, when you talk religion, everybody gets very defensive. Science today is giving us a language for this ancient wisdom where everybody can agree and everybody can see its immediate application. One of the problems today with having to move from national consciousness to global consciousness is that all of the systems that we've created are seen as just static systems rather than living entities. You know, in the time of the ancient Greeks, one of the things that was written over the doors of the Greek mystery schools is, man, if you would know the universe, know thyself. And one of the things that science is showing us today is that all of creation is holographic and fractal, meaning that all of the patterns that work for the big work for the small. This is why in physics, for instance, they're looking for a unified field theory, because general relativity and the big laws seem to be different than the laws at the level of quantum mechanics. And yet, on a deeper level, we know that they have to be unified, that there has to be something that ties everything together. And so when we approach our lives and the systems and organizations we create, we have to learn ways to see these as living beings. And if we understand the patterns that make ourselves work on a deep level, then we'll understand how organizations are born, created, grow to maturity, where their problem areas are, because we're seeing them as living entities, living beings, rather than just some static creation.
Well, you talked to a couple, I think, really important concepts, Georgia, that many, I think, don't fully comprehend, but you're really bringing out about, you know, organizations. One is, you know, this notion about common language, as you talked a bit a few minutes ago, and the importance of language really sets the tone and tenor about what do we really mean by what we say. And there's so many cases where people draw conclusions without really understanding what the other side's talking about. So language is a critical element, and the other one you talked about is, you know, organizations, they really are living, breathing And so many times, you know, particularly new leaders, give me the org chart, you know, put the wiring diagram together without understanding the criticality of going back to language, the relationships, the interactions, and organizations, they live and they breathe and they morph and they change. And the successful leaders are the ones who not only see that and understand it, they help the organization grow in ways that take into account the external environment, the internal set of players, where strengths and weaknesses are, not because it's about structure, but about getting the results and creating the environment where the organization can be as successful as possible in a world that is also changing around it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the language thing is so important. I find, and I've spoken to many, many different kinds of groups, not just in the holistic health field. I got to address some years back the Scientific and Medical Network at St. Catherine's College in Oxford in England, and also spoke for the Recon Trust at Regent's Park College in London. And, you know, you adapt your language to get your message across. For instance, if I find myself speaking to an audience with a largely Judeo-Christian background, I will say, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. If I'm speaking to an Eastern organization, I'll use the word karma. If I'm speaking to the scientific community, I'll say Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It all means the same thing. The importance is choosing the language within any situation that conveys the message and the meaning that you want to get across.
Well, yeah, some really great examples in different cultures, different locations, and even when we find in those who are trying to improve education, just as an example, we spent a lot of time, you know, one of the things we found, oh gosh, Elaine, was it 8 or 9 years ago in the discussion with one of the school superintendents was about high school dropout rate. And I asked the question, so Bill, what's the high school dropout rate? Well, 2 to 3%. I said, no, Bill, what's the high school dropout rate? I think I got them up to the high single digits. And finally I said, no, how many kids started in ninth grade and graduated at 12th grade? And it was a long pause. As you know, I don't know the answer to that question. So I think it's important that as so many people, as not only stakeholders in communities or whatever organization, they really help make sure people understand what they're saying before they go forward and draw conclusions that may end up with the results they're not looking for. And so I really appreciate your examples as you walk through that. And I can imagine Oxford, boy, there's a really interesting set of circumstances and dynamics, people from all different backgrounds to be able to have a good, meaningful dialogue and discussion.
Absolutely. One of the perhaps strangest areas that I've presented in was quite a few years back. I was asked, and by the way, again, in what I do, there are no colleges where you can get a degree, and yet just by word of mouth and forging ahead and doing what I do, I've been able to go into all of these pockets of academia. One of them was a prison, a men's prison. And one of my students was an official there and wanted to see what kind of change could be made if a group of prisoners who were some of the most violent, which they didn't tell me about until later, what kind of changes could happen if they volunteered for a program in meditation training. And so I initiated a program there for about 6 months, and it was amazing. And they found that the return rate went down. And after about 6 months, I handed over the program to my student, and it was continued for some time. So this kind of internal quest or internal work is not just a lone individual spiritual seeking. It has many, many applications to the wider community.
Well, this is Elaine Scott, Rick Stevens, and Georgia Lambert. We'll be right back after the break.
Mm-hmm.
Georgia, as we come back and take a look at this discussion, I'm wanting to push some things aside and be very personal for a moment and to thank you publicly and to acknowledge publicly that you were, in fact, the designer of the cover of our book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce. And I remember the joy that I had in asking you to consider doing that. And because I didn't have to say anything at all, I said, just go where you feel you want to go. And I would really love for you just to take just a couple minutes to tell us a little bit about how you went through a thinking process to come up with that cover.
Oh, well, aside from my real work, art has always been a great love of my life. As a child living in Europe, we got to actually take field trips to Florence and see the original Sistine Chapel and David, which was amazing. And I developed at that time a real great appreciation for Renaissance thought and technique. And art today is not taught the way that it was taught during that time. During that time, art was a multi-level process. In other words, you just didn't splatter your emotions on a canvas and call it art. There was a difference between art and artistic expression. Art had to lift and expand the vision, the aspiration of human beings. The arts came out of the Greek mystery traditions, and they were the way of taking abstract ideas and putting them into a form that humanity could recognize. So in the Renaissance, they developed techniques of starting with an abstract idea and then picking the geometry that would outpicture in numerical form, in geometric form, that particular idea. There is a different idea behind a triangle than there is behind a square, for instance. Then on top of the geometry, they would choose colors that would give an emotional layer to that mental structure. And then finally, the physical symbolism. So I approach my art in that particular way. And when you asked me to do the book, it was great fun. I got to combine lots of different things. And if people are familiar with the cover of the book, you will see first and foremost the god Mercury, who was not only the god of commerce, and since the book is a lot about that, that was appropriate. But Mercury was also the god of communication and the interface between humanity and divinity. So I thought that that was an appropriate symbol. And whether or not people know the meanings behind these symbols doesn't really matter, because it affects on a subconscious level. The soft gray rose has a sort of healing quality, which is certainly necessary in our international relationships. Of course, there you see the world. I have the Statue of Liberty, which is an actual photograph I took on one of my trips, with, of course, the lamp enhanced, shining between the old world and the new, between Europe and the United States primarily. And, of course, the lighted lamp brings to mind, the base of the Statue of Liberty, and the idea of this nation lighting the way in so many different avenues of expression. So that cover was great fun, and it was also a chance to bring together a lot of what I've learned of the deeper levels of how one approaches the art forms.
So as I think about the whole expression that you just went through, we're talking about basically a systems view that you created in a visual form of all these different systems, the Greek system of thought, the symbolism behind the statue, the knowledge of color, the knowledge of shape and design. And I know that in your work, there is a significant amount of systems thinking in the teaching that you do.
Absolutely.
And I think there are numbers of ways in which you apply that. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Well, again, this goes back to the man, if you would know the universe, know thyself, that as we move to the deeper levels of our being, as we move beyond, again, thinking of ourselves as our physical body or the emotions or the mind, and we begin to question who we really are as a living being and what is our place within the universe, we begin to understand the structures that support that particular identity. And they're called different things in different systems. We could say that, for instance, that within and interpenetrating the physical body is a body of an electrical nature, and this is being studied today by science via how acupuncture works, just as one example. If we can understand how the subtle levels of our being work, then we can apply that by the law of analogy to the greater systems we create. In art school, one of the first things that you have to learn is how not to draw yourself. When people learn portraiture, they unconsciously draw their own face on everything. And it's what humanity does. Whatever we create, whether it's a nation, an organization, a religion, whatever it is, it's an expression of ourselves. We can't help it. So if things aren't working externally, then we have to look at what isn't working internally. And as we fix the problem at the base, then anything that blossoms forth from that is going to be harmonious and true. So you apply the internal to the external because the pattern is the same.
So as we look at the circumstances that we find ourselves in today, for example, with the financial situation in the marketplace and those sorts of things, those things are not of somebody else's making.
No.
They're not divorced from us and our thinking and the way that we live our own lives and the circumstances by which we choose. They are, in fact, in my view, and I would ask you what your thought is, they are a reflection of thinking that is going on, you know, by massive numbers of people.
Exactly. And the decision not to think is also a decision, you know? we get what we allow to happen in many cases.
We get it by default or we get it by design, right?
By both.
Yeah.
It's two sides of the same coin going on simultaneously.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of the present circumstances, one of the things that I have found is that a visionary thrives in any situation because their attention is focused beyond the limitations of the present circumstance. And that's where we need to really look at ourselves today, because action, which is the only way to fix things, action can only be taken in the present moment. We can't really take action in the future, and we can't really take action in the past. All we can do is see this present moment as a place of balance between the past and the future, and then based on that balance, take action at that moment. If you're only looking at the present circumstance, you're not in a place where you can take action. There is a wonderful book written back in the 1400s by a Japanese samurai that was required reading in Japanese business schools, and that is the Book of Five Rings. And basically, it's a strategy of war. And one of the things in that book, it says that if you meet an opponent of equal strength and there's nowhere to take that, you gain the advantage by getting to higher ground. And that's really what we have to do. We have to lift ourselves up from the mire of this present mess to get to higher ground spiritually, mentally, morally, and then take action from that point of balance in this present moment.
And I would say, would you not, Rick, that's the sort of thing that we are asking community leaders and groups of people to do, to come together and work to build a shared vision based on shared values that they aspire to and find their way forward. Would you not agree?
With common language.
And
there's no question about it, because there is so much going on in the world today, and we all get stuck in our little activities. And what we want to do is come together so we can, in fact, go to that higher ground, which is about alignment, integration, shared values, shared vision, And that's really what allows communities to move forward and is to pull on the strength of everyone that's involved in Engage. So it is definitely spot on and an important part of the work that we do. I know, George, you talked about our book a few minutes ago. For those who are interested, our book is at www.birthtowork.org, and you can find that terrific cover that George designed for our book.
And a story that is looking to find its way to higher ground because it has a shared problem and a shared path for going forward. Georgia, many, many, many thanks, and as always, stunning words and use of language and beautiful pictures to help us all understand the notion of self-determined, self-motivated behavior that leads to success that affects the lives of many people. We hope to have you back soon to talk about some of your community activities and the sort of things you do to make a difference wherever you are. This is Birth to Work Radio, the voice of the community stakeholder leader, and we look forward to talking with you again next week.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.